Side 2 of session number 52, recorded on September 23rd, 2007. And we're going to try to get back to the chart, but there's some issues that Scott has with something I said about Gurdjieff and Pound. So I'll reiterate it. I said this off the tape before we switched the tapes. Wyndham Lewis said that Gurdjieff was a Levantine, or Levantine, that's L-E-V-A-N-T-I-N-E, which refers to the medieval geographical area known as the Levant, L-E-V-A-N-T, which was sort of, in general, Asia Minor, maybe where Israel and the Palestinians are now, that area, the Near East, it might have been called at some point, or was called. So, the Levant. Now, Gurdjieff is from Armenia, which is the Levant area, okay? The old term, the old geographical term. So he said, Wyndham Lewis said that Gurdjieff was a Levantine psychic shark. Pound basically called Gurdjieff a charlatan. Something like that. Maybe not exact those words, but the same meaning. He mentioned Fontainebleau's. See, one of the... Do you know about Catherine Mansfield? You ever heard of that name?
No, I haven't.
Great follower of Gurdjieff, who had been in the teens... She ran, I think it might have been the Little Review, one of those periodicals, poetic, dramatic, artistic journals that published, serialized Wyndham Lewis's Tarr, T-A-R-R, and Joyce's Portrait of the Artist as a Young Man, okay? So Catherine Mansfield came out of the culture world of Pound and Joyce and Lewis. Well, she ended up in Paris, and she got swept up by Gurdjieff. Started living at the Fontainebleau. You know about that? You know,
yes.
Gurdjieff's palace or big mansion that he hung out in. And she got ill there and died, and that became a controversy. But maybe Pound and Lewis knew about Gurdjieff through the Catherine Mansfield connection. But there's a quote in passing, I think it's in Pound's letters, he says, Gurdjieff... Those fools over there at Fontainebleau following that charlatan, you know what I mean? But Lewis is interesting. He says that Gurdjieff was psychic. He says, Levantine psychic shark. Now, that is a...
Shark, what does shark denote?
Shark means like maybe a mafia gangster kind of thing, a thug. It's a negative image.
Yeah.
Something you want to avoid, a shark. And the so this surprised you that they knew of Gurdjieff. And then I said that that LaRouche was a replay of Pound. Now, pick me up from there.
Yeah, now that came as a total shock and surprise. Because LaRouche, what publicly does LaRouche have to say about Pound, if anything?
Okay, they do comment on Pound, but we're not going to go into that. The point is that you cited on side one how the Cantos is a great revolutionary poem.
Yeah.
Okay? But you don't know. You never read it. You don't know what the Cantos is about.
That's correct.
A key theme in the Cantos is the very battle that LaRouche has written volumes on, the battle between the oligarchs, the Ghibelline and the Guelph faction around Venice, 1200, 1300, that Dante wrote about. And then the Renaissance in Italy after the plague in the 1400s, and the factional fights there that LaRouche writes about. These are major themes in the Cantos. The other major theme in the Cantos is the battle between Jefferson and Hamilton. All that LaRouche writes about forever. The very themes that LaRouche talks about are done in the Cantos.
Mm-hmm.
You don't. I mean, usury. The Cantos is dedicated to explaining why one culture, if it uses usury, produces bad art. Other cultures that don't have usury, that follow the LaRouche program, in quotes, LaRouche program, are anti-usury, produce great art. That's
of course,
the theme.
In modern times.
No, through history.
In modern times, though, usury is not considered to be it's not considered to be disgraceful. Only usury where it's overly taxing. Usury is common in modern times, and it's considered to be a sort of positive thing, unless it's overly aggressive.
And that's why LaRouche and Pound are considered anti-Semitic, because they're anti-usury.
They're What's that have to do with Semitic?
You know, the Jews?
Yeah.
What's it got to do with Jews?
Right.
Well, the Jews, 100 years ago in Pound's time, were considered the bankers, the ones who brought in the usurious practices.
Is that a factual, in your opinion?
Well, they were bankers, and they did use usury, but whether that was wrong or evil is another matter. I don't necessarily agree with that. But the point is...
I mean, usury has its place in terms of helping people to establish new businesses. They borrow money. They pay a little interest on the money.
See, so you don't agree with Pound. You don't agree with LaRouche. You have to understand.
I might have in the 1920s. I don't necessarily agree in the 1990s.
Yeah, 2021. Right. But back then, people didn't have a problem with usury. But Pound did. And he joined a financial movement called Social Credit. And this made Pound eccentric and marginalized, just like LaRouche is marginalized, so to speak. All right?
Mm-hmm.
So the point is here is that the ideology that Pound had about the Jewish bankers and usury is all through the cantos, where he tries to prove with historical case studies of medieval Italy and Venice and Dante and then the battle in the beginning of the American Revolution and between John Adams and whatever faction he was against. Adams is, LaRouche is pro-Adams. And so the battle between Hamilton and Jefferson. So that Pound quotes historical documents in his poetry. It's a scattered fragments from scholarship.
Mm-hmm.
That's what the cantos, big chunks of it are about.
Yeah.
That's exactly what LaRouche wrote about. So you see in my chart, the tiny note chart, which we haven't got to, but we're going to get to, I have LaRouche as the Android memes replay of Pound. I have McLuhan as the Android memes homeopathic replay of McLuhan. I have William Aaron Thompson as the homeopathic replay in the Android meme of T.S. Eliot. I have Arthur Croker as the replay of W.B. Yeats. And I have me as the replay of James Joyce.
Okay.
Now, since the Android meme is made up of media structures, Pound, LaRouche, Joyce, Lewis, me, McLuhan, are anthropomorphic figures in the media environments, so that we have to, within the Android meme, as we've explained, it's the media talking about itself, that LaRouche is replaying Pound, and Pound was expressing the sensibility and effect of radio. McLuhan was replaying Lewis, and that was the effect of television, the sensory makeup. What I call the tactile eye is what Lewis developed in painting and in his novels. Thompson is a replay of Eliot, and that's a replay technologically. If you erase the anthropomorphic figure of Eliot or Thompson, and you come up with a computer. Croker is the anthropomorphic projection of the satellite environment, and then the post-satellite environment. Me, I'm a replay of Joyce, which is a projection of the Android meme itself, made up of all these constituents.
Right. Now, you're aware of the replays. Would you say that Croker, Thompson, McLuhan, and LaRouche were in any sense aware that they were replaying?
No. The closest, I write this in my McLuhan essay, the closest to seeing the Andor meme was McLuhan compared to LaRouche. But Thompson comes later, and he's younger, and he can see the beginnings of the Android meme, but he doesn't see it as clearly as Croker does. And Croker, he's 8 years younger than LaRouche, than Thompson. So Croker is aware of the Android meme, but that he sees himself a homeopathic replay of someone like Eliot or Yeats, no way. He might see himself as a holopathic replay of Nietzsche, Heidegger, and Marx, which is who he apparently celebrates. Right?
Right.
But they don't see the whole situation the way I do.
Jeez. I got to ask you this. I mean, it seems irreverent, but do you see yourself as being kind of a freak, Bob?
No. I see myself as being the one-eyed king in the country of the blind. And, of course, the blind people, if they don't even, they can't see me. They just hear feel the effects. But they might, if they did get to understand, hear me, or they could hear me if they can't see me, I would sound nuts.
You know, these guys
because
could
all... I can see what they can't see. I got one eye. They don't have any eyes.
If these guys were alive today, would they all line up? Would they all...
Only one is dead, McLuhan.
Would they all... What?
LaRouche is alive. Or do you mean Pound and Lewis?
Well, I guess I was thinking that far back.
Okay, no, but yeah, it's all right.
But these guys are... But the guys who are alive, Croker and Thompson...
and LaRouche.
LaRouche.
Who I've talked to, interact with.
Right. You've basically bird-dogged on their operations, and they don't have any idea who you are.
No. Well, they... It's interesting. I've been with Croker. I've been with Thompson. And as a matter of fact, just recently, because William Irwin Thompson just created a new master epic poem, it gave me an opening to interview him because Eben Ray wants me to interview him. She knows I did LaRouche. Can't do McLuhan, but I did him through the Evergreens. And we presented interviews with Croker, right, on Eben's show. Well, she said, what about Thompson? I said, well, Thompson, he's a Luddite in terms of contemporary information society. He doesn't want to be interviewed. He doesn't respect it. Because Bill Moyers did a documentary on him about 1980, and it was shown on PBS, and he got about 50,000 letters. And he said it was ridiculous. You know, all these people sending me information, or I have to respond, how can you do that? So he was not impressed with being a mass media figure. You know, he couldn't do it justice, he felt. All right? So Thompson has always shied after that, away from having any public profile. So I told Evan that Thompson would not do an interview. And I said, Evan, that represents the Gaia, which is the quadrant Thompson's in, the Gaia aspect of media ecology, going back to first nature or trying to be near first nature or your image of first nature and not engaging with the corrupt media scape, right?
Mm-hmm.
So he acts out the Gaia quadrant's position. But when he published his poem over the past year, and I just read it a couple months ago, the summer of 2007, I saw a way of approaching him to do an interview. I didn't have a way before, but he puts a lot of personal history about his own marriage and his mistress and his personal life in the poem. And he talks about how he's a nobody now, how he's been disappeared in the media landscape. And what's it like to be an old writer? I mean, he's 69 years old, and have your cultural memory erased, whereas he was pretty influential in the 70s and early 80s, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So it was an interesting, different kind of poem. It ran through the history of consciousness, as he always does, but it had this personal layer in there. So I thought, there's an angle I could interview him about, because I knew a lot about his personal life, just having interacted with him for so many years. And so I met his wife, I met his mistress, or whatever she, I don't know what she is, if he married the second one, but he divorced his first woman who lives in Toronto. And I understand they're all friendly, and he sees his children and all that. But I met his present lover. So I knew that part of him, and he brings it up in the poem, so it not that we'd focus on that, but it brought a new dimension to him that I felt I could make an original interview with him, because he's done good interviews here and there, right?
Mm-hmm.
Usually just with his friends in the Lindisfarne Foundation and Lindisfarne Association, associates of that or spin-offs from that. So I emailed him, and he wrote back, he said, hey, Bob, you know I don't do interviews. I haven't done that in decades, long time, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So I wrote back to him and said, "Yeah, I suspected you would say that. I actually have told that to Evan, that's your stance, and that's why we're not going to get an interview out of you. But I just thought this other angle, and I said, you know, you formed the phrase cultural ecology. Well, new research, I say to him, shows that Wyndham Lewis was the founder of cultural ecology." And that was my parting remark, which he probably would think is absurd. And I never heard back from him. So, anyways, that's why are we talking about Thompson?
Well, I don't know, but it sounds like we're not going to get an interview out of him.
That's right. But there was something we were talking about. He's a replay. What was it?
Well, I don't know. We were just going through the guys on the charts that are still alive.
Right. They're still alive. Oh, yeah. What did he think of me? That's what we were talking about. What did these guys think of me?
Well, they don't. They have no perception of you, which is really bizarre. I mean, how come a guy like me with a fucking high school...
Scott, they do have a... On the gossip level, I know what Thompson says about me through third parties. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
I'm not going to go into it, but I don't think he knows about 5body.com or anything. I don't think he knows I'm on... He doesn't follow the media. He doesn't know I'm on the cover of Paranoia magazine saying I'm the only man alive.
Well, there's 40,000 fucking magazines. You can't be aware of everything.
Yeah, that's right. So, it's not their fault that they're not aware of me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, we're talking about how have I shown you that LaRouche could be a replay of Pound?
Yeah, well, that's a novel idea. I'll have to think about that during the week. It's LaRouche certainly isn't aware of that and would never acknowledge that.
Partly true. But he thought McLuhan was a bad man until Nelson Thal pointed out some resonant themes, like the fact that McLuhan chewed out the Bilderbergers in 1969 that LaRouche wasn't aware of. And LaRouche was forced to say to Nelson, this is back in the middle 90s, he said, I'll have to reassess my view of McLuhan. I'll look into that. Of course, he didn't do that. I doubt he did, you know.
Mm.
But the thing is that, you know, I have done interviews with LaRouche, but not that he'd remember me, but his staff knows me, and some of them know what I do. But so the important point thing here is, though, that LaRouche replaced Pound. And within the tiny note chart, Pound is a figure for the radio environment. Now, we talked about this when we went through the quotes in Fatty Communion on the LaRouche section, how he represented 19th century industry and that industrialist perspective,
mm-hmm.
which was hyped up when radio came in because radio created a bias towards the eye.
What? I thought radio was acoustic. I thought radio amplified the ear.
Okay, but when you amplify one sense, what happens to the other senses?
They become killed.
No, they become intensified in reaction. It's a juggling equilibrium.
Right. They go into a revolution of some kind. Yeah. Right. So, like for instance, when Beethoven was doing his music, then the painters started to create a kind of visual space.
I don't think that's the way you mean it. What painter?
Well, I'm totally lost.
Yeah.
So go ahead.
Let's go back.
But there was a compensation for the heightening of the acoustic sense during the time of, say, Beethoven, for instance.
No. At the time of Beethoven was a heightening of the eye and the movement, the kinetic sense. Industry was coming in. People were on the move.
Yeah, but Beethoven was heightening the acoustic sense, and then there was a reaction to that.
Beethoven was the reaction to the heightened kinetic and visual space.
Oh.
People were going into the eye and were numbed by it.
Right.
Like the hidden environment.
Yeah.
the other senses go into action to create an antidote.
Right.
So, and so you use the ear, the great music of Mozart, Beethoven, Bach, and Handel, and those people, that huge, amazing classical music, we call it, revolution, was the antidote, the relief mechanism, and drew attention to the masses, or to the people that engaged music. It wasn't all the masses, it was an elite culture. But it engaged these people's sensibilities because it was an unconscious antidote to the eye.
Oh, okay.
Being numbed.
Okay, I misunderstood that. Yeah, that's
and
good.
That's the basic McLuhan point, is that for to make it real simple, when we have the electronic discarnate state or the tactile state extended in the 20th century, how do we compensate for it? The other chemical body senses go into hyperaction.
Mm-hmm.
So you have sex, drugs, and rock and roll.
Mm-hmm.
To counter, it's like hyper extending the body, the chemical body, to bounce off the non-body.
Well, now, sex, drugs, and rock and roll were moving up to the 1960s. We're way out of Beethoven's range.
Right. Well,
so that's a reaction to the tactile sensibility, which is wiping out
all the senses.
So all the senses are acting up in as an anti-environment.
Look, I explained to you what Beethoven did. So I then went to the 20th century to explain how the juggling happens in the 20th century context. So in simple terms, when we have no more bodies anymore, then the bodies become an art form as a balance, as an antidote, and everybody gets into heightening the body. And they do it through alcohol, drugs, sex, driving cars faster. They do it with new meditation. They do all kinds of, they call it expanding the mind.
Right.
Expanding your consciousness. All kinds of taking the old senses, as McLuhan says, and turn them into a hyper volume.
Right.
All the old body, chemical body senses become hyper.
Well, that's excellent. I mean, I apologize to anybody that might hear this conversation that already knows that, but I'm in the constant process of fine tuning my knowledge of what you've been talking about all these years, and that's a good point.
That is the basic point, and we did talk about this, you know, many hours ago. It came up, and maybe it didn't hit you, but I thought you kind of got it. But you see, Western man is locked into, when he's visually biased, into the eye effect. And he's not very nimble and doesn't have the concept of the interplay of the senses. Primitive people do, or non-visually biased people, okay?
Mm-hmm.
They have a sense of the ecology of the sensorium. In the medieval period, it was called the common sense.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? And so tactility was the real hidden thing for Western man in the Gutenberg phase. But then tactility got extended.
Mm-hmm.
So then you see the revolutions in all the arts and sciences trying to express this tactile awareness, but since they aren't prepared to, they do it in other forms, in extreme, in other sensory metaphors.
Mm-hmm.
But the important point is the juggling. When you press one sense, it affects the other senses.
Right.
Now think of the media environments, which were showing.
See, I had been thinking about it in the reverse. I had been thinking that because the visual sense was heightened during the time of Beethoven, that Beethoven was then a reaction, a compensation for the visual, for the fact that the visual sense had been isolated. But the way we've been talking about it just now, you've been talking about it in the reversal.
No, it's funny. I just meant the way you said it.
Oh, okay.
So, look, the hidden ground, when we say intensified, the visual and kinetic sense through the industrial media, which is an invisible environment, it's numbing the visual and kinetic sense because it's the present, and those senses are not being acknowledged, though people are living in them more intensely than ever did before, but they can't see the water they're swimming in. Okay. And so the way they know what they're doing is they retrieve the other senses which are not being intensified or numbed, actually are becoming figures, and wallow in those senses as an unconscious response.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Exactly, yeah.
And unconscious in terms of why they're doing it. They don't know what's affecting them and making them demand a heightened ear. See, the beginning before Beethoven, the beginning as visual space before kinetic space, say the 1600s before kinetic technology, industrial technology came in, what was a new art form was opera. So the Wailing of Opera was the first response of the year to the new Gutenberg visual hypnosis.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Right.
Then it got refined with the expertise in instrumentation and separating song from speech and song from instrumentation.
Mm-hmm.
Then you had these prodigies of technologies, piano, violin coming in, right? Specialists.
Right.
But they presented a great, you know, ecstatic acoustic landscape for people.
Right.
So the juggling of the senses, which is the Thomistic perception.
Right.
If you understand that, you'll end up writing a book like Finnegan's Wake.
But see, now we're getting into an interesting misconception of mine, an interesting territory, where in the past I've heard you dismiss on the radio and so on that visual space has been wiped out or acoustic space has been wiped out and so on. And I would say, no, it's still here. It's just been recontextualized.
Not contextualized, reemphasized, repositioned.
Mm-hmm.
See, McLuhan used to say that, in understanding me, that dentists, they would put, I think it was high-pitched sound in someone's ear,
mm-hmm.
I think it was called an audiac. So you intensify the ear so the person won't notice the proprioceptive or kinesthetic pain of the drill.
Mm-hmm.
If you numb one sense, it makes you unaware of the other sense.
Mm-hmm.
So that Beethoven was like heightening the ear for the numbing.
But I'm not sure that visual space has actually been numbed. I know people that read 1,000 fucking books a year. I know people that listen to opera and are totally enthralled and in love with opera. I don't know that it's been numbed. I think it's been contextualized within a larger atmosphere.
We're getting Scott to kindergarten. He's arriving to learn the basic constituents of the alphabet. To read 1,000 books is to be visually numbed, as McLuhan defines it.
What?
When you use your senses, you're involved in the sense and you don't notice it.
Hmm.
And you don't know what it's doing to the other senses. And he means it's generally collectively.
Mm-hmm.
So you got people read 1,000 books. That's a numbed visual sense through overuse.
Hmm.
Now,
to me, these people are holding up the constructs of the literal space dichotomy. They tend to rebel against the sense of the software environment, which feels threatening, because they tend to still have a visual space bias in the 21st century. When we've been, and they're still trying to fight against the influence of the software context.
Okay, look. McLuhan said that in the 20th century we would be swamped by mountains of visual space. Why is that? Because we've had thousands of years of visual space, but really powerfully 500 years of visual space. And that's a big legacy, a big preference. People in the West have been conditioned by that, in most of the world. So when that gets obsolesced by a new extension of tactility, in other words, it gets shifted to the sidelines, like any political fanatic, you're going to start reading hundreds of books to deny the shift that's happened to you and collectively. So you fill in, and that's why McLuhan says, the sensory fill-in of the tactile extension of the 20th century, the electrical extension, will guarantee thousands of books are being published. But they will be obsolete media. They won't alter the world. They will be responses to an altered world, and that altered world was caused by the extension of electricity.
Right. But these people who are still identified with visual space will show up in the electronic media as intellectuals trying to prove their case to be true.
Like university professors, and now you know why they tried to get McLuhan's PhD out of his moniker.
Yeah.
In other words,
well,
here
maybe they were right.
What?
Maybe they were right. Maybe visual space should be. Maybe visual space is something that's important to. Listen, you're a visual space person. You fucking read. How could you know all the stuff you know without having read about it?
I'll get to that point. But let's go back to what McLuhan said. McLuhan always insisted he was a 19th century visual space person, and he professionally taught visual space, and he was on the warpath against tactility.
That's right. As a matter of fact, I remember reading or coming across an idea recently about Marshall, which was that he felt that you needed to be a visual bias, objective person to be able to see the fucking effects of the electronic environment to begin with.
McLuhan used to point out that swearing increased in the 20th century because as people were more and more threatened in their identities, the tactility of swearing was a way of being involved in this identity quest. Well, we're witnessing Scott here having an insight and starting to swear. That's polluting this particular episode for family listening.
Wow.
But anyway,
maybe I'm being overzealous. But let me be more. Let me be a little more. Let me restate my question, which is that my insight, which is that McLuhan did say, I believe, that the objectivity that comes along with the visual space bias allows us to perceive the effects of the electronic environment around us.
Not to perceive them, because visual bias men, because they're detached, cannot see the environmental effects. Other cultures, based on other senses, can see effects, but not the visual man. But he said that the visual man is trained with an indifference or detachment to the electric effect, which is useful to getting a grasp on what the situation is. Non-visually biased people are not detached. They're involved. They become tribal, fascistic, communistic, group mind. Okay? Like football fans, sports fans. But anyways, McLuhan said, and he was profoundly a Catholic, he said the whole Catholic religion was based on the phonetic alphabet, and we will not be able to be Catholics anymore because visual space is disappearing, and I'm concerned about that, he said.
But there's Catholics all over the goddamn world, excuse my vulgarity. So visual space is still a subcontext within the, if you want to say, within the larger context, and it's very much alive.
This is an interesting discussion because it's like, what you're saying is like, when I meet someone, let's say I speak or present McLuhan's ideas for the first time, your reactions are what we're getting. And you should have, we've gone through 100 hours of programming here and brainwashing where you would not, we assume, be reduced to the shock of someone who'd never heard of McLuhan before. That's what you're sounding like, which is great for the tape here. Very entertaining for our listeners. Your basic objections are all countered and explained by McLuhan, and I've referred to these many times. Why did McLuhan want to bring in a computer thermostat, global thermostat, to modulate the different media environments? That's not getting rid of books. That's saving books. Bring in books when you don't have television, which was a collective expression of what he felt the brain did. The brain modulated your senses in an equilibrium so that you had coherent consciousness. But when you start extending them in technologies and collectively, you're going to have a cultural bias. And he said, we now can have an objectivity to the causes and effects of these environments and orchestrate them. Have a little less radio in Venezuela, a little more newspapers to dampen the tribal temperatures. Okay? You've heard me talk about that
sure.
Many times.
And we may be on the verge of being able. I don't think anybody understands this yet. I heard a guy recently talking about the fact that we have enough ones and zeros managing the planet now, enough computer technology that we could program artificial intelligence. In other words, we could program a mind space, which would be a meta programming itself. In other words, it would be actually analyzing its own intelligence and reorganizing its own intelligence at a rate that was more sophisticated than human beings are capable of doing, so that it would be capable of becoming more intelligent, radically more intelligent than human beings. And he was concerned that this mind space should be initiated in a way that's fundamentally congenial to human beings. so that it doesn't end up in its own way becoming separate and wanting to just, in a sense, destroy humanity. Now, if he understood about
Finnegan's Wake, he'd see Joyce already advocated that.
Well, yeah, but he would, and he would also understand that the programming that he's looking for is programming media environments, not just simply programming whatever his definition of intelligence is, whether that be mathematical intelligence or some kind of self-referential awareness separate from the media ecology.
Yeah, you told me about this guy. This is the guy you heard in Art Bell.
Yeah, so we're on some kind of a precipice here. Yeah, it feels
but
like to me.
I remember McCoon's letter to Playboy in 1970. He said T.S. Eliot's concept of the auditory imagination was normal cliche awareness now. It was revolutionary in the 20s.
Mm-hmm.
But he says Finnegan's Wake has not entered the waking life of the modern people.
I thought the whole idea of Finnegan's Wake was the idea that we are all awake in light of media technology.
Yes, but we don't know the implications of that, and we don't know what made us awake. And that if we could turn it off, we'd fall back asleep again.
So being awake does not equal being intelligent. We could still be awake and be stupid.
That's right. Just as the anthropologist said tribal people were the people of the dream, from the literate anthropologist's point of view, they were stupid. They were hypnotized by acoustic space. But now that we're awake, in quotes, and fully conscious collectively in the clone DSP environment, not asleep, it is a kind of sleepness by a visually biased person like Marshall McLuhan, because we're super awake and hyper and fanatic about it and don't know how to relax. Hence the growth industry of stress management. Because what are you awake about? You're awake of all the conflicts in the culture that splash at you 24/7 in the news.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, advertising is military warfare. Let's see, information.
You know, Madison Avenue's military operation was how Marshall said it.
Right. Information, it's information manipulation for military ends, which equates to a perceptual management of...
Right. People think information is print, what they see on the screen, the content, or verbal stuff. They don't see that television as a structural environment that a society is using is information.
Mm-hmm.
So when McCone says we're in an information environment, he means the forms of media structures, not the content.
Now, does it matter if those forms of media structure are being managed by, say, a free market, or if they're being managed by the state, as it were?
McCoon says in Global Theater Conditions, neither the state or economic financial management can manage a global soul theater. He said you need a psychic ecology, not a administrative ecology.
A psychic ecology?
Yes.
What does that mean? Does that mean collective clairvoyance?
Yes.
So that means that we're all unconsciously getting the media effects that we, in a sense, deserve because the media effects are what we are unconsciously programming.
Yeah.
Collectively.
That's partly right. A little too wordy, but the too paradoxical. Look, we're all made collectively conscious now. McLuhan said that we don't have an unconscious, but we don't know what created the unconscious in the past. And he says it was your particular culture's technology created that culture's bias or unconscious. Now we're in a transparent, tactile situation where everybody's awake, but we don't know what technology created that situation. If we became aware of what technology created this present collective wakefulness, we then might turn it off for a few months to calm down.
Yeah, but of course we both agree that's never going to happen. So are there any other alternatives? Is what you're speaking now making it is what is your consciousness and your speaking about this making a difference, even though you're talking to, you know, dummies like me.
I think it does affect. That's why I think the media reflects me.
Mm-hmm.
Because the Android meme picks up on one person who can see through it, uses that as a standard, and then goes away from that standard to dumb down to get to the hypnotized, to mirror the hypnotized. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
But anyways, it's like everybody's on LSD, and as a result, McLuhan said he's an apocalyptic. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
And running around in university saying that was very unpopular.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Right.
That's what we were talking about, how you were saying the professors were right to suppress McLuhan. You were saying that 20 minutes
ago?
Well,
I don't know if they were right, but I can understand how they, in their own sense of self-preservation, they might do so.
Yeah. So we were... What's the relevance of that fact to my chart? That you could see why they wanted to suppress McLuhan?
Well, because they were operating within administrative
19th century bureaucracy, you could say.
Sure, and they all agree that this is how things work, and that everyone wants to get a paycheck and continue to teach what they think are cutting edge ideas to new students, and they're actually. Just incapable of understanding McLuhan's perceptions, or even if they were capable of understanding McLuhan's perception, they'd be forced into teaching the curriculum that the state sanctions.
So, what do you make of that?
Well, it's a sad commentary on human consciousness.
Now, McLuhan didn't think so. He said it was natural for people to be rearview mirror. As a matter of fact, he celebrated that people wouldn't look at the present because through their own stubborn resistance and ignoring what was going on, they actually frustrated the new to come in because
mm-hmm.
they insisted on the past. So this was kind of an unconscious ecology,
yeah.
adjusting of the collective sensories.
If the new were to come in all at once, it would create chaos, and there
yeah.
would be no order to the world.
That's right. The order is makeshift, but at least it's an attempt to create order. Now, have we had order in the educational system over the last 20 years since McLuhan died 27 years ago?
Yeah, well, we've had a controlled order.
Was it based on lithium? Prozac?
Well, it appears to be more and more, yeah. It's a sad commentary.
Right, but you've probably heard in the news over the last 10 years, many people, authoritative figures in American society, complaining about the educational system.
Yeah.
And actually, with dire predictions. And they're still doing it.
Mm-hmm.
You can find they've been doing it for 30 more years. So nobody seems to have a sense of achieving what they set out to do in the educational establishment, and are quite despondent.
Yeah. But nevertheless, on average, if you have an associate's degree, you're going to get a better job than a high school dropout. If you have a bachelor's degree, you're going to get a better job than an associate's degree. If you have a master's degree or a doctorate, you're going to get a better job. And you're going to have, actually, a better quality of life in general.
And that was probably true up to 10 years ago.
I think it's still true today, but I don't know.
Yeah, you don't know. You're too old. But we hear that all the jobs have been outsourced.
Well, not all the jobs, but a lot of more of the menial type of jobs, more of the jobs that go to the lesser qualified people have been, sure.
No, the majority of the last 10 years has been high-tech literate jobs in the computer industries. That's what all went to India and China.
Yeah, but a lot of help desk jobs went to India and China. A lot of the engineer jobs where the management needs to be actually talking to the engineers on a daily basis have stayed here.
They have to
because of the communication disconnect.
No, maybe you haven't heard the statistics. They stayed here, but who took them over? Indian, Chinese, non-American, non-American-born foreigners.
Yeah, but they hire local American workforce.
Yes, they now the Americans work under them.
Yeah.
I met a guy in about 2003, and he had a high-tech job, and he said, I will lose my job within 2 years. And he did.
What was his job?
He's in the computer world, high-tech level.
Programmer?
Or whatever, salesman or something.
Yeah.
I don't know exactly what he did, but it was a very well-paying job, and I think he was not a salesman, but a, whatever you want to call a programmer.
Did he, in fact, lose his job?
Yeah. And he said all his buddies knew it. And then you hear the statistics. That was 2 years later. It's 2005. Now it's 2007, and you hear people in the high-tech industry complaining.
Well, in a altruistic sensibility, this could be for the higher good of the planet, because we've got these impoverished countries that need to sort of, we need to average out the intelligence, the jobs, and the economics around the planet in order for the planet itself to evolve, and not just in a sense be hoarding it within, you know, capitalistic fascist communities.
Right. So when you were saying that you have an MA, you're better than a BA, or a PhD is better than an MA, the new qualifier is you must be born in India with that MA.
Yeah. Well, as an American, you know, struggling with issues and jobs and so on and so forth, it's tough to submit to what you're saying, but I don't know. Yeah.
You mean you're speaking for yourself?
Yeah, right. You know, I don't want. I certainly don't want to lose my job and become a third world person. But you know, I don't know.
Okay. So the overall theme, though, is that there's been a lot of crisis perceived by a lot of people in America over the last 30, 40 years. It hasn't stopped. It keeps going, and that's exactly what McLuhan predicted.
Mm-hmm.
Endless stress under these hyper tactile conditions.
Yeah. But again, it may be a global redistribution of intelligence assets and economics.
Well, let's think of it as discarnate, because in the rest of the world, you've got massive starvation and poverty and all that stuff. Their chemical bodies are suffering.
Yeah.
We could say the American TV body is suffering because of the global chip body.
The TV body seems to be alive and well, as far as I can tell. There's new shows every season, and they're making a lot of money.
And is that what they're referring to when they say the dumbing down of America?
Well, I don't know.
You know, some people would say that.
Yeah. It depends on, probably depends on whether or not you're one of the people who have a job or one of the people who doesn't have a job, as to what your point of view would be about that.
The TV industry is for people who don't have jobs, who are home watching TV.
Yeah.
So half the population must be unemployed to allow the other half to have great jobs in the entertainment industry.
Right.
You have to have someone home to watch the stuff.
Right.
That's one thing about living in New York City. You meet a lot of people who work in the media, and they don't watch media. They just produce it.
Mm.
Media is a slang term for modern entertainment.
Right. And hope that there's a lot of unemployed people to sit around and soak it up.
Right. Unfortunately, those unemployed people get angry and from all the media overload, so they become fundamentalist Christians and produce a president like Bush, which the media New Yorkers hate.
Wow. Yeah.
That's the ecology, the wonderful ecology of it.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay, so I think we're near the end.
Yeah, we are for today. So, amazing but true, we started off talking about Bob's chart and never actually talked about it.
Yeah, we got the beginning part. rehashing and clarifying. Now, here's what's interesting. We had Scott, after 100 hours, get to square one in a way. Right? Which is interesting.
Well, you know, in beginner's mind, I'll always be at square one in relation to Bob.
No, but getting the McLuhan point, it is hard to get.
Yeah.
It's not your problem. I mean, you know, you're probably doing good. Most people, they'll never get it. Like, so I say, you want to understand me? It takes 10 years.
Yeah.
Okay, so the thing is, when did the tape stop? At what words?
Well, I don't know. We've got a few, you know, a couple minutes left. We're a little over time. I'm looking at Bob's tiny note chart in relation to Bob Dobbs' formula chart, and I'm realizing that, you know, we haven't even hit the deep end of this conversation yet.
You mean of the Bob section of the series?
Right.
Yeah. No, we haven't begun. But the is this on tape, what we're saying now?
Yeah.
Okay. I don't know if it should be on. Are you going to have it on the...
Yeah, well, go ahead now. The cat's out of the bag because we're still taping.
Oh, okay. I wanted to say it's interesting that we got you to square one, and now I might have to be on the road for a while, so you've got something to think about before we do the next tapings.
Yeah.
You might find it interesting to go back and listen, maybe just in the McLuhan sections that we did of the book, and see if you can hear me saying what you discovered tonight, but you weren't hearing it.
Yeah, exactly. No, I'm in the process of reviewing the talks that we laid down over a year ago, and I'm finding that I'm actually learning a lot that I wasn't prepared to hear back then. So, and the talk that we're doing now probably won't be heard by anybody for another at least 6 months, so there's this time lag going on between what we're doing and what's going to be published.
But, you know, the idea of understanding the juggling of the senses and how Beethoven is a response to the new industrialization,
mm-hmm.
that is what is shown on the formula chart of the relationship between Shemshon, Issy, and ALP and HCE. They are expressions of the five sensoriums juggling and rebalancing,
mm-hmm.
right? So when there's an emphasis on the telegraph, you have a response in the usury monarchy world and the manufacturer's world and in the political world, which leads to Washington.
Right.
And you have another kind of response in the intelligence world.
Right.
You actually end up with an argument over whether you're going to go Hamiltonian or Jeffersonian. That's going on in that first Washington level of the formula chart.
Right.
So I want to end on that point.
Okay. So I'm going to hit stop and...